let me tell you, thank you for joining us. And today we're going to talk about the most dangerous place on Earth. And you may wonder where that is. Well, how about these statistics? It's number 12 ranking among failed states. That's just below Haiti and just above North Korea and Burma. It is home to the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and Osama bin Laden. It not only has nuclear weapons and the ability to fire them, but it has been the primary supplier of nuclear weapons to rogue nations. Yes, with friends like this, who needs an axis of evil? I'm talking about Pakistan. Pakistan has recently come into the news because of Musharraf's declaration of emergency rule, his imprisonment of political foes, his removal of the Supreme Court, etc., etc. But my guests today, Anthony Levy and Catherine Scott Clark, have written a major book called Deception, Pakistan, the United States, and the Secret Trade in Nuclear Weapons. And they make the point in this timely moment that while we weren't watching, while most people were so unaware of what was going on in Pakistan and what was going on with Pakistan, it has been the most dangerous place probably for many years. And so this recent attention is probably a good thing. Adrian Levy and Catherine Scott Clark are award-winning investigative journalists who worked as staff writers and foreign correspondents for the Sunday Times of London for 7 years before joining The Guardian in the UK as senior correspondents. They're the authors of two highly acclaimed books, The Amber Room, The Fate of the World's Greatest Lost Treasure, and The Stone of Heaven, Unearthing the Secret History of Imperial Green Jade. Their latest is, as I said, Deception, Pakistan, the United States, and the Secret Trade in Nuclear Weapons. They've reported from South Asia for more than a decade and now live in London and in France. Adrian Levy?
Adrian Levy here, yes.
Okay, and I understand that Catherine is it's 9 o'clock where you live in France, 9 p.m., and Catherine is probably tending to the two young children.
You guessed correctly, yes. That's why you got the lesser choice and you got me.
Well, as I said when she emailed me that that might be a possibility, I said you've got your priorities straight.
Sometimes we do switch around, but it is my turn tonight.
So, okay.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Very good. I like people to get a little feel for the people behind the ideas and work that we're going to talk about for most of the half hour. So besides finding out that you're a parent who has worked for years with your partner and the mother of your children, which is an interesting insight, the other thing I want to ask about is you look at your first two books, The Amber Room and The Stone of Heaven, and these hardly suggest the people who are about to write about Pakistan and nuclear weapons. Talk about that paradox.
Well, two of the books are based in Asia, the first book, The Stone of Heaven, and this book, Pakistan. And both of those two books come out of our more than a decade's worth of reporting in Asia. All three books involve repressive regime and difficulty of access. The second book involved the former Soviet Union and closed archives, which we've been chipping away at. So all three kind of employed similar methods in that we spend a lot of time in archives doing archival research. We spend very little time on the internet. We spend an enormous amount of time traveling, sitting down, meeting people face to face. So I think they were all about creating documentary trails. Mostly, I would say the thrust of our work is mostly in Asia. That's where our real feel is. But the Amber Room story was one that we just couldn't really shy away from because we want access to a cultural archive, which we've been writing to for years. So we kind of fell on our luck with that one, I guess.
Yeah, I remember when that one came out. So Amber, Jade, and Uranium, right?
I know. There is actually a tangential link between all three books, which is perhaps elemental. But no.
Depends what the most favored jewel is at a particular time, right?
Depends which dictator you're talking to, I guess. The Chinese dictators or the Chinese new oligarchs love jadeite. And as we know, the Pakistani oligarchs, the military flavor, love uranium. And as for amber, sadly, it has historic value, but no great material value.
Okay, let's shift to the topic of Pakistan today. And as I prepared for this, I realized kind of what I said in the introduction, that that Pakistan is not a country that Americans pay much attention to. My guess is, you know, up until very recently, most probably couldn't tell you where it was. It's one of those stands. Aren't they all kind of near where Borat comes from or something? And yet, you know, as you lay out, not only are they probably the most dangerous place on Earth today, but they may well have been, at least in practice, for many years, and with the cooperation and deception of at least the U.S. and the U.K.
Yeah,
what I'm going to ask you to do, and I'm just setting this up for you, is I feel we want to know the past. How did we get here? We want to know the present. What's going on there right now, you know, as it sort of changes a bit day to day? And then what might be the future? And I'll set you off on that path and ask questions as they come up. But I mean, I really feel like we've got basically 20 minutes left, and we've got a lot of learning to do.
It's fantastic, isn't it? I know. We'll make this a crash course. But I think, you know, if we're super reductive to start with, this is all about feast and famine. And there's this complete lack of consistency over three or four decades to do with Pakistan. Pakistan goes through periods of being loved very amorously by the West and then rejected when it's not needed strategically. Loved again amorously when we need it for security purposes and then rejected again. And it just happens that the periods in which we love Pakistan and we need it for security purposes also coincide with the rise of military dictators in that country, and the time that we despise Pakistan and ignore it are when fledgling democracies try and grow in that country.
Let me interrupt for a second then. It sounds to me like there's a relationship there. In other words, if when we didn't need them so much while they were struggling to maintain democracy, we aided them in other ways, perhaps we wouldn't end up in the pickle we're in when they return to military rule.
You know, this is precisely the story. I mean, let's just throw some very, very quick numbers at this so we can get a feel for it. I mean, you know, during the Reagan administration period where Pakistan was needed and we were amorous and mating with the military there because of the Soviets' invasion of Afghanistan and Pakistan providing a springboard into Afghanistan to feed money to the Mujahideen who were fighting the Soviet troops. During that period, there was at least $11 billion legitimate aid dollars and anything up to $50 billion of black aid coming from the CIA. And yet, through the 90s, when Benazir Bhutto would stand twice as prime minister and take the seat twice, and Nawaz Sharif, her opponent, would stand and take the seat twice, you know, aid was roughly around the $1 million a year. And then, of course, after 9/11, Pakistan becomes the number one ally. And as we know, according to Washington research and audits, it's approximately $10, $11 billion that's landed in President General Musharraf's lap, of which 96% has unaccountably gone into the military's coffers, only 10% to humanitarian aid. So there is a common theme here, which is that the instability we're seeing now, we deserve.
Well, and let me just, occasionally I have to do this, when someone, you know, rattles off a number in the middle of a paragraph, you said that under Reagan during the Soviet war in Afghanistan, we gave at least $11 billion and maybe up to $60 billion. That since 2001, since 9/11, we've given another $10 billion. And that during the periods in between when they had democratic rule, we gave $1 million a year?
Sure. I mean, there's a whole period of censure and sanction, really quite duplicitous, that comes in there. Because throughout the 80s, when Pakistan was developing its nuclear program and Reagan was certifying every year, along with other officials in his administration, that Pakistan had no bomb and was not seeking a bomb, the money would flow. And then when the Soviet troops withdrew from Afghanistan, this unbelievable turnabout happens where suddenly Bush Sr. steps in and says, well, actually, you know, they have been procuring. You know, they are developing a WMD program. I'm going to cut aid off. So having taken an unstable, cantankerous country which has elevated coup to a national sport and given it a WMD program, everyone then turned its back on it. And, you know, lo and behold, we see through the 90s they're milking that cash cow, spreading nuclear technology for hard cash. And, you know, we're in the position we're in now with the armed axis of evil and all the nuclear showdowns we're facing with Iran, etc.
Okay, so that's the pattern. Let me also go back to one thing you said, that during that time when we're arming them with somewhere between $11 and $60 billion during the Soviet the war the Soviets against the Afghanistan Mujahideen, it's pretty clear then, or only after the fact, that a lot of that isn't going to fight to arm the Mujahideen, that a lot of that is probably going to develop a nuclear program. And then I would ask the same question again. If we've given them 10 or 11 billion since 2001, we have no pretense that that has gone to fight the Al-Qaeda and Taliban in the rural areas, do we?
No, I mean, you know, cash is fungible, and in most cases, money was delivered in cash. I mean, literally, a star lifter would set down, the ramp would drop, and, a pallet with dollars strapped to it would be kicked out, be received by the hands of a brigadier and the inter-services intelligence, pervasive intelligence directorate in Pakistan, and then it would enter ISI bank accounts. And in fact, you know, a good deal of auditing that went on, conducted by US and British agencies, showed during the 80s that vast amounts of money was vanishing. Now, one Pakistani general who ran the program told us that the official budget for the Pakistan operations during, let's say, the early to mid-80s was around $16 million a year. That's all the government coffers could give them, $16 million a year. And yet, procurement figures drawn up by British intelligence and the Foreign Office showed that Pakistan was buying, over the same period, between $300 and $500 million worth of technologies from Europe and America for its WMD program, the shortfall being siphoned from USAID. But, you know, this idea of where the cash goes, which will be a very much a repeated theme post 9/11, is not the only means by which the Pakistanis develop their program. There is also a kind of much deeper sort of conspiracy, although I hate to use that word, that goes on, a piece of pragmatism, shall we say, that's going on within the Pentagon. And that piece of pragmatism is to license for export prescribed banned components for the WMD program in Pakistan that have been banned by other US agencies, including the Customs Service and Commerce, etc., etc. And when the CIA attempted, thinking that it was on the mission to interdict WMDs, attempted to disrupt the Pakistan purchases, the CIA found that key presidential appointees throughout the 80s, and particularly in the latter half of the 80s, Reagan officials in the State Department, two at Assistant Secretary of State levels, were blowing these operations to their Pakistani oppos in Islamabad and Rawalpindi. And that became the subject of, in itself, a covert inquiry. But the result of the inquiry was that the diligent agent at the CIA who discovered this was himself castigated and squeezed out of the CIA, and the same would happen in the Pentagon. And in fact, that is a repeated pattern, because post-2001, post-2011, and I think you may have seen this reported really well in the Philadelphia Inquirer and a few other papers, the State Department has once again been purged of old hands who were very much warning about Pakistan and the rise of the new dangerous, unstable Pakistan, and those people were given early retirement and shipped out of office and replaced with younger ideologues who stuck with the Iraq agenda. So there are very much comparisons. And the third one that I'd make is that there's a pattern of behavior that emerged. It's not just about cherry-picking intelligence or sitting on it or politicizing it, as we saw in Iraq, but it's about hounding and monstering officials who choose to act independently and diligently. So we see in the 80s a CIA official who loses his security clearances for exposing the complicity of U.S. officials with Pakistani officials. And we see his wife, who's also in the CIA, turned against him, and we see both of them hounded in a way that would be resound again post-2001 with Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson. And the same groups of people are involved in both cases.
What you're telling us is, when you say the same groups of people, in other words, the folks who were in the Reagan administration, departed during the Clinton administration, returned to power with the election of Bush Jr., are the same ones doing the same things?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's very much under the rule of Dick Cheney. It's also connected with the circle working with Wolfowitz. It involves Louis Scooter Libby. It involves Stephen Hadley, Eric Edelman, who's still in the Pentagon negotiating. They were involved with the CIA agents hounding a man called Richard Barlow, whose case will finally come to the Senate Armed Forces Committee and Judiciary in the next 2 weeks. And they were also, of course, involved post-2001 with Ambassador Joe Wilson and the outing of his wife, Valerie Plame, of course, a story we all know very well about.
Very good. I'm Terry McNally. I'm speaking with journalist Adrian Levy. He and Catherine Scott Clark are the authors of Deception, Pakistan, the United States, the Secret Trade in Nuclear Arms. People, you know, have only learned maybe in the last few years how Iraq was created by the Western powers. How did the nation of Pakistan emerge, and why such a different path since its emergence than its neighbor, India?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a vital question, you know, because what a lot of this is about is the rise of the Pakistani military as a political class, and their chosen political method, which is the manipulation of Islamist, conservative, radical Islamist factions. That is the story of Pakistan. Pakistan's differing from India. Obviously, they both come about with the bifurcation of the land, the creation of partition in 47, and a random line of partition. Of course, this is where the British cocked it all up, and as your listeners may recall, in fact, a British civil servant sitting on the top deck of a double-decker bus in London randomly sat with a lap on his map, having never travelled to the country, and for topographical reasons drew a line across the country dividing towns and villages, leading to the massacre and bloodshed that followed, at least 1 million people dying in partition and the creation of Pakistan. But the difference between India and Pakistan was, first of all, India came off better. It retained more natural resources, it hogged more of its own army and materiel, and Pakistan was the poorer brother, definitely came off worse. But also, with Pakistan, they made no immediate moves to create legally, constitutionally a separation of powers between the military and the civilians, whereas India crafted diligently a way so that the civil service, the elected politicians, and the military were all separate beasts. And that meant that the military were always, throughout Indian history post-partition, governed and very much the servants of the constitution of India. There's only ever been one period of emergency rule under an Indira Gandhi, and throughout the rest of the time, for better or worse, it still remains the largest democracy in the world. Now, Pakistan was different, and the military began to absorb more and more power, and dictators came and go. There were many coups, and at every stage of democracy, the military would undermine it in order to create a self-fulfilling prophecy, which is that democracy was weak and that only the military could, in a patrician way, rule Pakistan.
So, and you talk about that the military has a unique position in Pakistan, and I know there's that one instance where Benazir Bhutto, though she is prime minister at the time, is basically running errands for the military.
Yeah, no, this is exactly right. I mean, you know, the military... I mean, first of all, just throw a few more tiny little indicative figures here, because they do help. I mean, if you look at them now as a class, they own about 12% of all Pakistani real estate, of which only 70,000 acres are for defensive reasons. The rest is business. You know, they turned over last year £10 billion, which is the same profits, roughly, as made by the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank in Europe. I mean, they are enormously rich and capacious. They've seized control of everything from cornflakes to petroleum. And when civilian prime ministers come in, like Benazir Bhutto, who was roughly 35 years old in 1988, they do all they can to hamper them. They created a coalition of Islamic forces, which they funded and gave intelligence to, that then bitterly attacked her. And she recounted an amazing story of walking into the prime minister's secretariat for the first time and discovering in there that there was nothing at all. There were no files, no pencils, no paperclips. And she rang up immediately the president. She said, well, there's nothing in the prime minister's secretariat's office. And he said, oh, yeah, the military took everything. And she therefore had to clamour to get everything back and send people off to Washington and London to look how an executive runs. And, you know, in other occasions, she would be dispatched on missions to North Korea and then entrapped, as in one remarkable story, when she was forced to have a Christmas dinner, effectively, with the North Korean president and find a way of dropping into the conversation that the military wanted to buy missiles, something that hadn't been briefed prior to the meeting. So they very much are vassals and manipulated by the military, and the military go to extraordinary means to humiliate and undermine them.
I mean, let me jump in for a second.
Yeah,
so
sure.
This issue of Musharraf having taken power in a military coup, with claims of corruption, which we don't have time to go into, against Bhutto, which we don't have time to go into now, and this question of whether he would give up his military role to remain in power is a big deal.
It's a big deal. I mean, it's a very big deal. But, I mean, we're looking at different things here. The military themselves are also considering their long-term future as a corporate entity and as the strongest unified force in Pakistan. And, you know, there are so many issues that we could draw out here. But I think the most extraordinary one is something that we, you know, I like the way you introduce your show, the need to reconfigure things that are stale ideas. Well, the stalest idea coming out of Pakistan at the moment, projected very much by key U.S. officials, is that if it isn't Mush, if it isn't Musharraf, it'll be, you know, the bearded Islamists who'll have their finger on the trigger. Well, you know, this is absolutely a misinterpretation of everything that's going on in Pakistan. Musharraf and the military are manipulating the Islamist factions, and the Islamist factions themselves have never polled more than 10%. You know, there's no chance of an election happening and a Hamas-like resurgence happening with the military being battened down and bearded Islamists coming in and taking control of the nuclear trigger. This is a fallacy that just supports the idea, the simple political idea of military-to-military support. Pentagon talking to Army House and Rawalpindi. Much easier than the messy business of building a democracy in Pakistan. Mm-hmm.
And you know, also it justifies past action and inaction.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, it is drawing a veil over our inability to understand the complex Pakistani society and give it succor and support when it needed it. And, you know, attempting to build strong civil society, elements of that, grassroots political parties. I mean, let's face it, if you were a poor villager living in the northwest frontier or in Waziristan, where Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are arise again, and you're squeezed between the jihadists and the Pakistan military who are manipulating both factions, you know, and there's not even a local police force to protect you, you're going to fall one way or the other. You're between a rock and a hard place.
And
most Pakistanis are moderates.
And let me ask you, basically, you've got about 2.5 minutes left.
Okay.
What would be the wise move, either by this administration or the next administration, in its relationship to Pakistan? And what is likely to happen with Pakistan elections and Musharraf?
Right. Look, there's some critical things that need to happen straight away. First of all, it is time for whichever administration comes in to get to know their ally or enemy, depending on how you look at it. Understand their philosophy, understand their military strategy. You know, just one thing I'll throw up in the air here. We always presume that it's in the interest of the Pakistan military to support the war on terror, but in fact, what they want is Hamid Karzai in Kabul, the leader there, kicked out of office because he's not conservative enough. He is pro-Indian and pro-Western, so we have two conflicting policies. They've never looked at Musharraf's track record or, in fact, what his strategies are. So I would call for an in-depth look and an understanding of who the Pakistan military are, as we're paying them so much to be our allies. Secondly, cut off aid and redirect aid towards humanitarian civil society building projects. Stop paying for the big ticket items that give the military prestige and they use to flout support for the West, and start insisting on nuts and bolts answers. We want a program whereby money fits with actions, and we must most of all get to know and understand and give succor and support to the democratic forces that are progressive. Now let's just recall in my final 4 seconds here that you know, when we've seen all of these arrests that have been made in the name of you know, the war against terror and, you know, Musharraf's fight against terror, the only people rounded up are the progressives and liberals who are Western-looking, pro-American and pro-British. You know, we've got to basically create a situation where we understand the strategy, we have money that we can trace and audit, and it targets specific things that are useful for the Pakistani people, and that, my God, we mustn't alienate the ordinary people of Pakistan anymore. You know, I was recently in Karachi, and I was sitting down with people who are middle-class, teachers, professionals, lawyers, etc. And these people who would have before frequently traveled to the West, and, you know, they're very much entrepreneurial and pro-Western, are gradually getting more and more alienated from us for our continued support of dictatorships. They are not a banana republic. These are intelligent, cultured people of a moderate background who are looking for democracy. It's time that we supported that.
Very good. One last question, just so people get the sense of it. What's the population of Pakistan?
Population is 166 million approximately.
Half as large as the U.S. or a little larger. And the middle class?
The middle class, it's difficult. That is a very difficult thing because no accurate census. I mean, the middle class is growing. It's like India. You know, it's growing.
Okay, but I mean, we're talking about a substantial number of people. So again, I've got to bring it to a close. The book is Deception: Pakistan, the United States, and the Secret Trade in Nuclear Weapons. The site where you can learn more and stay in touch with these excellent journalists is clarkandlevy.com. Thank you, Adrian Levy, and keep up the good work.